Hey, everybody. My name is Mike Gibb. I run AccountsRecovery.net, and I'm excited to be moderating today's webinar on best practices in mitigating TCPA risks. Of course, TCPA stands for the Telephone Consumer Protection Act. The TCPA itself is a very tricky statute nowadays for the credit and collection industry. While everyone waits for a new rule from the Federal Communications Commission, courts across the country are issuing different rulings and interpretations of what constitutes an automatic telephone dialing system and more. In this webinar, a panel of leading credit and collection industry compliance experts will share their strategies for managing TCPA compliance in today's climate. This webinar is being generously sponsored by NEA Insurance Group. You'll get the chance to hear about them a little later in our program. I want to take a quick minute and say a few words about AccountsRecovery.net. AccountsRecovery.net is a news and information platform for the ARM industry. The site publishes unique and curated content, maintains a number of email newsletters, hosts webinars like this one, and offers a number of exciting podcasts for the ARM industry. The site is free for anyone in the industry to use, and is a great resource of news and insights to help educate and inform. I hope you'll all spend a few minutes every day checking out what it has to offer. Now let me tell you a little bit about today's speakers. Alicia McKeegan is the Chief Compliance Officer at AFNI, Inc. She's been in the industry for 10 years and has experience building and enhancing AFNI's compliance management system. She also has experience with the FDCPA, TCPA, and FCRA litigation and regulatory licensing. She's a member of the ACA Federal Affairs Committee and holds a credit and collection compliance officer designation with ACA International. Ryan Thurman is the Director of Sales and Marketing at Contact Center Compliance. With 20 plus years of experience in the contact center industry, Ryan has developed deep expertise in the contact center technologies such as ATDS, SMS, Avatar, ringless voicemail, as well as legal issues such as the TCPA, HIPAA, and FTC regulations. Ryan also has expertise in domestic and global compliance with a concentration on state and federal marketing and privacy regulations. He's a frequent moderator and panelist of industry events. Unfortunately, David Linares has a scheduling conflict and is unable to participate today. The format for today's webinar will be a panel discussion between myself and Ryan and Alicia. We encourage everybody to submit questions and we'll get to them when the discussion has concluded. To submit a question, please enter it into the question tab on your Zoom webinar control panel. This event is being recorded and a recording will be made available in the coming days on accountsrecovery.net. Finally, I just want to take a quick second and ask everybody to fill out the survey that should pop up on your screen when the webinar is over. And you'll also receive a link via email tomorrow to access the survey. Participating in the survey helps me develop content. That's what you're looking for. And make sure that the speakers are the people you want to hear from. So I would encourage everybody and ask everyone to take that survey when they get it either later today or tomorrow. With that, I'm done with the introductory remarks portion of the webinar. Let's launch into our discussion. First, I thought we'd start at a high level before starting to drill down. And Alicia, maybe you can give an overview of where we stand from the perspective of legal and regulatory landscape about what is and what is not allowed under the TCPA right now.
Sure, Mike. Well, first of all, thank you for having me today. I'm excited to talk to everybody about the TCPA. It's certainly a very fast-moving target, very complex at the moment. So kind of just to answer your question, it's in a state of flux, obviously. We've had two really interesting and important rulings this year. We've had in 2018, we had ACA International in 2018, and then Marks in the Ninth Circuit. So, you know, basically, ACA decision set aside the FCC's clarification on which devices qualify as an ATDS, and it also set aside the clarification on calling a reassigned number being a violation. So then you have the Marks decision that comes along, and that's in the Ninth Circuit. And the Ninth Circuit basically reasoned that the FCC's previous guidance and 03 and 08 was incorrect, and they set that aside, but then said that the definition of the ATDS was vague enough that it really could include stored numbers that could be called in dialing such numbers automatically. So it kind of muddied the waters because it looked at the ACA decision and said, we're not going to follow this, but then somewhat pulled it back into the decision and said, we're still going to use the same outcome, but provide different reasoning to get to that outcome. So following Marks, there's been kind of two different paths that they've gone on. It's either the Marks path or the Bad Reyes path, which held that the FCC's 2003 and 2008 orders remain in effect. So with that being said, with kind of all of that, there are a number of different decisions in a number of different jurisdictions that have differing kind of direction that one would need to consider. And then you also, on top of that, have all the human intervention cases that basically state that, you know, human intervention is required in manual dialing, and your human intervention would be met if you have the right timing. So you're calling a number and you are intervening right at that moment, then there's proper human intervention. Or if it's just a click to dial system, that would be proper human intervention. So even within the human intervention case line, there's some diversity there as well.
Awesome. Excellent. Thank you for that. A ton of information in there, and I'm sure we'll be coming back to that throughout the conversation today. Ryan, is there anything you wanted to add in terms of where you think we stand from a legal and regulatory overview standpoint with respect to the TCPA right now?
I think there's a couple other things that are going on that are of big concern. One is the trend to corral text messaging, SMS, and group it in with ATDS, and per the Marks decision, you get a lot of these plaintiffs' lawyers that are trying to make those kinds of claims. And you also have a trend with the platforms themselves, the Twilios, the Five9, LiveVoxes of the world, that are kind of now being targeted and brought into cases, whereas before they kind of had the common carrier rule built in. And that's very kind of dangerous. And also the whole stem of cases that are kind of flooding the courts, especially now that you've got this supposed $928 million case out of a company that was doing some multi-level marketing, robocalling, that may or may not end up with that kind of payout. But ultimately, it has a lot of these cases that are not only involving text and robocalls, but they're basically filing cases that essentially they're just making a claim that a dialer was used. They really don't care, you know, from one way or the other, whether it was actually a human dial or was some sort of system that, you know, was designed to be compliant with TCPA. They want to see how much you're willing to settle for. And so then you get the issue with the whole that, and the other piece that we're really watching closely, which is reassigned phone numbers and how that database is going to be rolled out.
Excellent. Following up just for a second on something you mentioned with regards to the number, the platforms, sort of kind of being included in the discussion or in the legal battles now. You mentioned that being dangerous. Can you expand on that a little bit?
Yeah, before, a lot of companies were very successful at litigating against those kinds of rulings because of the kind of common carrier rule. And I'm not an attorney, but basically it was kind of like the equivalent of like, well, you can't sue the gun manufacturer for what people do with it. And that had been pretty consistent for a while, and then the courts have started to just kind of make irrational decisions, and there's other bad cases, kind of like how Marks was like the one that there nobody thought was coming, and now you have kind of this trend where you know, the platforms themselves have been looped in, and then you've also got the FCC kind of weighing in on technology such as ringless voicemail, where, you know, that was pretty common. Now people are kind of, I think, a little bit maybe going to shy away from that because essentially they're saying, hey, it costs the consumer to go get their voicemail, or, you know, it's not technically going to get around TCPA. So that's the other angle that I think I see them coming down on. And unfortunately, that, you know, it for a lot of people, it was just that extra touch point they needed, because ultimately, having a cell phone number is going to be your primary best way of getting a hold of a consumer. And now they've got all kinds of ways to opt out and or complain about that call and throw in a TCPA claim and a loop in a FCRA and whatever else they can find at the state level and see what you're willing to walk away from for it. So that's the dangerous thing. Kind of adds more fuel to the fire.
Awesome. Just what the industry needs, more things to worry about. With everything we've talked about so far, there definitely seem to be a lot of potential landmines out there, at least as it pertains to complying with the TCPA. Alicia, I'm curious if you had to sort of prioritize or rank the risks, where would you see the greatest risks today as it relates to the TCPA?
Yeah, good question. I think, you know, the first one that I would advise any individual to look at that's in charge of compliance with their company is your communication platform. You need to fully understand the capabilities of your communication platform, inside it out. The white papers that the communication platforms provide is great, but also, as Ryan was saying, read any cases that they're involved in. If you can have access to any of the discovery that was provided in those cases, that's helpful too. And then understanding based on that how you should format your policies and procedures and your monitoring and auditing. There is as I kind of went through earlier a little bit fast, but there is a lot of geographical diversity in the holdings for the TCPA right now. And the best way to ensure that you have a consistent message and you have proper procedures and controls and that you understand exactly what your company is doing is to understand your communication platform and design your policies and procedures from there and ensure that your auditing and monitoring is ensuring that you are understanding correctly what your communication platform is capable of.
Ryan, is that what you would you would? How does your rankings look if you were ranking the risks of, you know, as it pertains to TCPA compliance?
I think that question depends on who you ask. Like if you were to ask folks in the lead gen business, they would probably tell you that it's the people filling out fake lead gen forms and finding ways to basically kind of get onboarded as a customer that then they turn around and nail you with for TCPA suits. Or if you're B2B, it's folks like a Bonnie Reuter Plumbing and these companies that are like shells for TCPA lawsuit factories. If you were to ask, you know, more debt collectors, I think the big thing on the table right now is the government-backed debt deal, which I know we're going to talk about later, but that one seems to be pretty monumental. And I think the other thing is just more of the fact that now the FCC clearly is going to get more involved with TCPA, whereas before it was like more private party plaintiffs. Yeah, you'd see a couple FCC cases mostly going after the big robocallers and that sort of racket, but not necessarily so much focused like the CFPB. They're kind of, you know, were a little bit not the one you see enforcement. In fact, in teleservices or contact center, usually it was the FCC who's more active. Whereas now there's a big push for more enforcement, because the other thing driving a lot of these regulations is just the sheer number of illegal robocalls that's just gone through the roof. Everybody's getting neighborhood spoofings like through, you know, so bad that you can't even answer a local call. I think that sort of thing is the other thing that's dangerous, is it's they're having trouble using the rules they have to regulate the, you know, illegal traffic. So I think the other thing coming down is stir and shaken, which is really also something to watch for sure. Or shake and stir, whatever it is.
I guess it just depends on how you like your drink.
Right. What time of day it is.
Excellent. Well, I want to pause the discussion briefly, and I'd like to invite Otto Forster from NEA Insurance to come say a few words. Otto?
Hey guys, Otto Furster here. We're talking about something that's pretty particular to the call center space, to the debt collector space. You know, we got two panel experts here that really are phenomenal when it comes to their expertise in their chosen path as, you know, advisors and technicians when making outbound calls and how to be as compliant as possible. You know, my thoughts when putting together a panel, we're looking for people that really know their craft. We're blessed to have some really quality people here that can help answer questions and really, you know, dive, you know, below the face value of some people's concerns or issues with regard to outbound calling. You know, our reason for being here is just to continue to try to educate the community of outbound calls, whether it's debt collections, any kind of call center, enterprise, that there's actual risk-bearing insurance where you can take the risk of TCPA off your balance sheet and put it with a risk-bearing insurance company. And, you know, I feel that many people in this business are unaware of the insurance products available to them. And I'm not going to spend much time, you know, talking about that, but it's really just about letting people know that there are insurance companies available to help reduce or mitigate that TCPA risk from a risk transfer standpoint. So, both of these individuals who are speaking today really can help with that mitigation. And then, you know, if you further want to look at, you know, taking that risk to a risk-bearing insurance company, that's my business practice. And, we can assist with that. But I really don't have much else to say except that I'm super excited to continue to get some opportunity to learn a little bit more about what these panelists here have to say, because their expertise is really valuable.
Awesome. Well, thank you, Otto, and thanks again to NEA Insurance for sponsoring today's webinar. I just want to deviate from our prepared discussion topics for a moment. We got a question that came in from the audience, so I wanted to use this as an opportunity to remind everybody, if you have a question, please type it into your Zoom webinar control panel, and we'll do our best to get to it before the end of the webinar. But the question that came in, what is the best practice for how to have agents request express consent to make future calls? Ryan, Alicia, one of you want to tackle that one first?
I mean, I would say, you know, definitely get it in writing. Is the best. You can get oral consent, but I always look at it as, you know, you want to have the most information you can to positively prove that you've gotten consent. And you also want to, I would recommend using some sort of technology like a trusted form or a Jurnia consent level or some other way where you can actually record the transaction of them doing any kind of opt-in online. So that if you get the common complaint that comes around in TCPAville that says, hey, this wasn't me, I never gave this consent, I don't know how that happened, you can be like, well, how many times would you like to watch this video? I think that's, you know, pretty good best practices and seems to help out when that comes up.
I would definitely agree with what Ryan said. You know, definitely some of those technologies out there that you can get in terms of, you know, proving who opt-in, getting it in writing. I also think creating scripting for your agents, if you're going to take it verbally, ensuring that you're retaining those audio recordings for as long as you plan on using that consent to call those individuals with an auto dialer. You know, of course, there are certain things that you can build into your script for those individuals to request revocation or revoke their consent. It doesn't hurt to put that in place. Of course, anytime you get any revocation in any manner, the best practice is always to honor that revocation and not continue to call those individuals. But some of those scripted practices, some of the technology that Ryan referenced, definitely help with having solid controls in place.
Excellent. Thank you for the answers again. Thanks for asking the question to the person who submitted it. If you have a question, type it into your Zoom webinar control panel and we'll try to get to it before the end of the conversation. So far, you know, everything we've discussed, there definitely is a lot in flux right now, both legally, regulatorily, I guess from a regulation standpoint, between the FCC working on a new TCPA rule and the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau allegedly putting the finishing touches on a proposed debt collection rule that may come out as early as next week. Where do you see, or where do you recommend companies or individuals look for guidance about what they can and can't do in order to try and make sure they're complying with the TCPA? Ryan, maybe you can go first this time.
Well, I think looking for guidance really takes a couple forms. One, I look at it is kind of the way I handle it, which is tracking for, you know, what's the latest and greatest. I think you guys do a good job on your site at Accounts Recovery. And so there's some other portals out there that are good blogs from some of the law groups about the daily goings on, also what's going on at the house and the things like the TRACE Act and following around some of these state initiatives and other bills is another thing that you want to kind of be aware of. Then there's the, you know, kind of bigger picture, attending webinars, going to summits. We put on some of our own TCPA summits, and I try to follow where I see conferences kind of covering this information. Certainly the ACA and some of these other groups are good, but I like more focused TCPA. There's so much going on right now that, I mean, you could spend a day at an event and still be, you know, debating, you know, what's the definition of a preview versus a click to call versus what court you're in, or, you know, we've got the FCC coming down with some potentially hopefully harmonizing definitions. So I think you got to kind of stay tuned to kind of all these different channels. So, you know, that's kind of the way I handle things anyway.
Alicia, how about you? How do you sort of stay on top of what's going on? And then also, how do you make sure that the people, you know, sort of within the company are on top of everything they need to know as well?
Yeah, sure. As Ryan referenced, I mean, your site does an incredible job of providing a lot of the needed information. One of the resources that I use in addition to your site, it's tcpaworld.com. It is a fantastic resource. A lot of the information that I kind of prepped with on the first discussion on Marks and ACA International and the two different lines of reasoning that have now come from Marks, all of that is on TCPA World's website. They also provide you kind of a tick-by-tick case of different things that are going on in TCPA World. Also, Inside ARM has it's insidearm.com/TCPA-resources. They have a real-time feed of all of the different TCPA cases and whether or not it's positive or negative for the industry. So that's a good reference. But of course, all of this is just information. So you need, you know, your own set of legal counsel or your you know, trusted individuals that can provide some interpretation to all of the information that's being provided by these different resources. I would say in terms of the people in your company having the same knowledge, ensuring that they have access to the resources that I've just talked about and having frequent touch points on, you know, what the rules of the game are and how that may be changing based upon the jurisdiction and the different activities that are occurring. And I think finally, you know, as I mentioned earlier with the question on some of the risks and understanding your communication platform, doing some auditing and monitoring to ensure that, you know, even though the individuals in your company, you know, perhaps operations or your compliance partners say they understand the communication platform and have put proper controls in place and have proper policies and procedures for your agents, auditing that and monitoring that to ensure that that's happening.
When you talk about auditing and monitoring, is it sort of like testing employees or is it something more than that?
Sure. Well, it's something a little bit more than that. I would say you know, from a manual side, from your monitoring standpoint, it's listening to phone calls, listening to, you know, if you have some voice technology, you know, like such as CallMiner, you know, scripting that to ensure what exactly you're expecting from the script to obtain consent is being said by your collectors, and the proper follow-up discussion is occurring. You know, anytime that there's revocation discussed or automatic telephone dialing system, having, you know, those keywords alert you to listen to those calls. I would say from the auditing standpoint, you know, understanding what your standard operating procedure is for your communication platform, what restrictions you're expecting to be in place and expecting those restrictions. So, you know, if you have a do not call list or a revocation list, looking at that revocation list and ensuring that, you know, after this was added on this date, it was not called again. So there is a complex kind of automated audit that you could design based on the different controls that you have for your communication platform, and then some more manual monitoring that you can do with your agents to ensure that they're following the procedures that you expect.
Awesome. Excellent. Another question to come in from the audience. Here's the scenario. We use SMS for payment reminders. We obtain consent over the phone to send an opt-in SMS message. After the consumer opts in, they will receive messages based on their payment schedule. The consumers can opt out at any time. Are we in danger for violation? Is the question. Does anyone want to have an opinion?
I can give you a way that they could get set up that I heard about recently, which is interesting, which is, so with SMS campaigns, what a lot of plaintiffs trolls are doing is essentially looking for ways that the automated SMS platforms are it's going to look like you're opting out or trying to opt out, but hoping that the system doesn't catch it because the bot doesn't detect it. So, you know, writing things like "don't bother me" or a little haiku poem, or the one that I heard about, which I thought was really clever, is basically they write "stop," but what they do is with the S key, they're holding it down to get the character that looks like kind of like an accento kind of, but it's not another foreign character like language is for. But if you put that in and put "stop," they were catching SMS systems that were not processing those opt-outs. And what they would do is they would take the screenshot of the S of them opting out, but they would crop it so that you wouldn't see the S with the accent. You would just see a normal "stop," and then with their filings. But they, and one of the attorneys that was in our last summit talked about this, that they got through discovery, somehow they were able to sleuth this out. But basically they're putting the opt-out language with that "stop" character out there, and then they do the filing, and then all of a sudden you're going like, okay, wait a sec, this person tried to opt out, but we, you know, clearly you want to take them out. But things like that that are just kind of by design are crept into a lot of these guys' strategies, so I'm told.
Another thing to worry about. Ryan, you mentioned the recent Fourth Circuit ruling regarding the unconstitutionality of using ATDSs to make calls on debts guaranteed by the federal government. Do you think that's going to have an impact on either other types of debts or other types of calls, or, you know, any other area of the TCPA?
Well, it's very interesting because it involves the First Amendment free speech rule. And so I haven't quite digested some of the lengthy stuff that's out there, but I think overall it opens up that debate for regulating speech, but also provides a lot of opportunities for some of these high volume collection situations, which involve some government-backed debt, student loans, IRS, whatever, where that could be attacked by plaintiffs looking for, you know, a way to get a paycheck out of something that now all of a sudden could be construed the other way. So I think it's kind of a pretty monumental decision. I haven't really got all the details, but I mean, I think that it's one of the more fascinating ones. That kind of like the Marx decision, I don't think people really saw necessarily headed in that direction.
Elise, have you had a chance to read through the ruling or digest any of it yet and sort of get a sense for what impact it might have on either your business or you think on the credit collection industry?
Yeah, so I've read a little bit about it. You know, it is very interesting to me. And I think, you know, as Ryan just said, it wasn't something that the industry was predicting in any manner. In fact, there were, you know, there was a case prior to this that led to this appeal that went the exact opposite way. So, you know, what's interesting to me from this case is that they ultimately said, you know, despite finding the exemption violated the First Amendment, that it could be severed from the statute. And so the plaintiffs, I think they requested them to strike all of the ATDS regulations, and that was not honored. So it's, I think, the progression of this particular line of cases will be interesting. What I also think is interesting is to see now if pressure from, you know, the government, from some of the student loans, from the IRS, you know, kind of increases the timeline that the FCC then provides new guidance, if perhaps maybe that was not as high a priority. Perhaps now it is with this new ruling. I don't know if there's any weight to that. It's just something that I thought was interesting coming out of it.
It is interesting. With all of the disparate rulings out there, it can be difficult to, I guess, understand or know to any degree of certainty when you can use an ATDS versus when you can't, especially given you're not even ever really sure where the person you're calling is, just because maybe they've ported a number. So I'm curious if you could walk through some best practices or some a checklist or just some ideas as to how companies should approach the use of ATDSs when making calls. Ryan, would you mind starting?
Sure. So if you're going to use an ATDS, I mean, I would look at it as using anything that's in that department. You want to basically make sure if you're going to call a cell phone number, make sure you have proper documented consent. Anything that usually my clients are doing with ATDS, they're scrubbing out numbers that are matches on our serial litigant solution and ways to kind of get rid of those folks. They're verifying a lot of times that the numbers are aligned with the right party contact information as well, meaning that they're checking that that person still owns a phone number and also checking for reassigned phone numbers. So as you have data that if your ultimate goal is to get consent, which because it's your golden ticket, that consent can evaporate if that number gets reassigned, which is partly why the FCC is finally going to try to provide some data for that, because right now it's been kind of monopolized by the carriers and you can do it, but it's not really like going to give you a safe harbor. It might give you some good business intelligence, but it's not an absolute get out of jail free card. So I would definitely recommend that. And I would also recommend talking to multiple attorneys about what your system truly is by definition of the law and get some opinions about what your risk level is. And don't necessarily, like Alicia said, you know, just get white papers from your vendors, dig a little deeper and find out, you know, how their systems are being ruled in the courts. I find that a lot of people are not necessarily misled, but they think they found some great technology to increase contacts, and a lot of things now could be construed a dialer or have been involved in some cases, and some of them are, you know, dependent on how you're obtaining consent, how you're tracking it, what industry you're in. And so I think that's a kind of a, usually what we recommend.
I would also say on that, I mean, it's kind of a, is the juice worth the squeeze situation, right? So if there is a level of efficiency that you can get to by using a communication platform that would likely not be considered an ATDS, but still have the call volume or reach the you know, kind of dials per hour that you would like to, or a lesson target that maybe is exposing you to less risk, you know, consider that. That's an option for, you know, some companies. I would also say, in addition to all of the great things that Ryan mentioned on this, monitor what your clients are providing you in terms of files as well. You know, they also have the option to have, you know, if the consent's being passed to you from them, to have the consent revoked at their level as well. So you need to be monitoring the files that are being sent back and forth to your clients. And, you know, another thing to consider is if you somehow get that account back, so perhaps you had this account in primary and then you got it back in TERSH after it went to another collection agency, you know, scrubbing against your own systems to ensure those consents are that were revoked are now being revoked. There's a lot of opportunity for consent revocation to get lost in the mix of all of the file transfers back and forth in your system and your client system, and who it was requested from, and if that agent marked it in the client system appropriately, and if it got transferred to you appropriately and went to your system. So I would just say be very careful about that. And, you know, earlier when I mentioned auditing, that's something that you certainly should build into your auditing when you're when you have a client for which you're making calls to cell phones with an ATDS.
I had actually written about something today. It wasn't TCPA, it was FDCPA, but the collector was able to use the bona fide error defense in part because there was language in the agreement between the collector and the original creditor that said that any information that the creditor is sending over is deemed to sort of be accurate. And there was some information that wasn't, which led to the lawsuit, but the collector was able to get a summary judgment using the bona fide error. Is that something that, you know, collectors or collection agencies should also be, you know, be aware of, is putting language into the agreements with their clients that kind of can help them provide some risk mitigation in this area?
You know, Ryan, maybe you can comment on this a little bit, and I'm going to step a little bit carefully. I think reps and warranties are great in contracts, but a lot of times that's all they are. You know, you have client relationships that you want to maintain. You have litigation costs that you want to keep down. Oftentimes, fighting the good fight and pursuing bona fide error is much more expensive. So, you know, I am thrilled for that company and that they, you know, decided to pursue that path, but there are a lot of logistical challenges that go into pursuing that.
Okay. Ryan, you talked about some of the things you were seeing with the SMS issues and how some plaintiffs were trying to be opportunistic. Are there other strategies you're seeing or other techniques from plaintiffs or plaintiffs' attorneys related to the TCPA that people should be aware of?
There was one I heard about from a guy who just, he was actually using a text platform, got sued in Michigan for non-consented SMS calls or texts. They're treated as calls, but they're essentially his case. They found we had the attorney and a couple of his numbers on our litigator file, but we didn't have a couple of his new numbers. And when the guy getting sued did some research on this character, the guy on his website basically says, hey, I get new numbers all the time. I just collect them and wait for calls on, you know, what I consider to be dialers and too. And so it's the people who basically collect phones to wait for the wrong party calls. those ones are, you know, you see those a lot, like with Diana May was one, and then I think the other one was, what's her name? Melody Stoops. She was the one that actually, she was in Forbes, talked about how she did this, but they've had some kickback from these kinds of situations where people are just doing it to kind of defraud people. So the good news is there's been a couple cases where the defendants have countersued under kind of fraudulent claims, you know, like, hey, these people are signing up under false pretenses. They're not using the phone for their regular business. They're only using it for, you know, kind of a honeypot scheme. And so there's been a couple cases. I think there's one, there's a Franklin case that was kind of interesting. It wasn't too long ago. So those are kind of good trends that where, you know, they've been able to show that, hey, this person came in under false pretenses. I had another client that was sued by a very well-known plaintiff, Craig Cunningham. I probably have 40 or 50 numbers on that guy for litigator suppression. Anyhow, he had signed up with them under the false pretenses, and he changed his name to Craig Cunningham, claimed it was a typo because they already flagged him and taken him out of all their campaigns, suppressed him off of everything. But then he got a new phone number under that name. And this client of mine actually is, I think, trying to form some sort of like a fraud case against him because, you know, he signed up under false pretenses. So, I mean, it's just the extent that these folks will go that are really looking to exploit companies is just amazing. Some of the stories that you hear, I'm trying not to name too many names, but I mean, some of these plaintiffs, I mean, this is what they do. You get folks like Anton Ewing out of San Diego. He comes up all the time. Abonte Reuter, they're the plumbing company up here that just, I walked out of a conference a month ago and about half the people I talked to have been sued for TCPA. We're all getting corralled by these people because these phone numbers that they're getting are business numbers, but they're getting cell phones and they put them out on all these directories. And these guys that consume large amounts of B2B data, they get hit with TCPA suits all the time from all these lists that they thought were just businesses. So those are some of the things that I think there's really going off the charts on the plaintiff's kind of tactics.
Well, Alicia, is there anything you're seeing over and above that?
I've seen a lot of that. We also have scenarios that I've heard of in the industry with us and some of my colleagues where it will be a forwarded phone number. So you have something that you think is a landline that you're calling, but in reality, they're forwarding it to their cell phone. And sometimes they can provide records, sometimes they can't. You know, most of the time they never knew that information, you know, that call was being forwarded. I think that's an interesting strategy oftentimes because even though you could probably navigate that and, as I said earlier, kind of with the bona fide error procedurally and legally, you know, fight it, it gets very expensive. So the forwarded phone numbers are also an interesting strategy. And then just in general call baiting, you know, as I said earlier, the agents that are taking consent and, you know, receiving calls where consent may be revoked, ensuring that they're scripted and there's very specific procedures because there are attorneys that, you know, have their clients call and have a specific script that they're using as well to try and kind of outwitch your collection agents.
I'll add another scenario that I heard about recently, which was interesting. Met a firm that did bankruptcy consolidation kind of work. They're an inbound shop. And the guy told me that he was real familiar with TCPA. He worked with a lot of plaintiffs. And what they do is on the inbound bankruptcy questionnaire, they ask the people if they're getting calls for debt collections. Are they on your cell phone? Oh, great. And then they sell that lead to one of the bigger plaintiffs firms that's out here that got three or four attorneys that come up all over all the time. it's just shocking. I mean, that's how that this system just keeps growing. And then you get firms like Morgan & Morgan down in South Florida. I mean, you drive around down there and they advertise, you know, hey, getting calls on your cell phone, blah, blah, blah. So people are, you know, enticed into thinking they're going to get some payback. So that doesn't help.
Wow. No. So in light of these new strategies that the plaintiff side are using, let's talk a little bit about what are some of the best strategies to defend either a TCPA suit or the threat of a TCPA suit. Alicia, would you mind taking that one first?
Yeah, absolutely. I've pretty much already hammered this question in, but it's just know your communication strategy, have everything very well documented, have your policies and procedures in place. If, you know, perhaps you want to pursue discovery in the matter, ensure that, you know, what you're going to providing isn't going to surprise anybody in it. Ensure that your call records are pretty secure. You know, I think oftentimes a situation can occur where you have call records and you think that everything looks great, and then oh, there's a 5-second call, and it's like, yeah, the consumer picked up and hung up. Well, that must have been the one where they revoked consent. So there's really the best thing that you can do is understand your systems, every piece of documentation and record that you could have, and understand how that information is going to work for you when you get some of these just ridiculous TCPA lawsuits, and be willing to fight some of them. So despite the fact that I've said, you know, in a lot of responses previously that, you know, litigating the matter is very expensive and sometimes not worth it, at some point you do have to provide some pushback to these plaintiff firms, because they will just keep coming to you for settlement after settlement. So you have to show them that you're willing to put up a fight and that you have the information and the policies and procedures and the records and the understanding to do so.
Excellent. Thank you. Based on some data that's available, it seems like the number of TCPA suits is declining, albeit slowly. Ryan, do you anticipate that trend to continue?
I don't. I don't see it going too far south. I think that, you know, the folks that are involved in it have gotten kind of a little bit smarter in the way that they're going about some of these cases. Like, what I've heard is sometimes what'll happen, they'll kind of come on in a little exploratory mission. You'll get one or two complaints. They kind of get some info. They kind of check you out. And then they'll come back when they have a bigger class action, for example. So I think that, and if you look at the some of these big numbers that the case was it was an Edelson case, you know, $928 million, you're going to see more people jump on the bandwagon. But, you know, I think the numbers from our side are kind of outstanding, are a little overwhelming. Like, we put somewhere between 50 to 100 litigators a day on our list of new phone data that we flew together. And we have a total of over 200, almost 200,000 numbers overall. So, I mean, to me, that still seems like a growing problem. And the way these guys go churn phone data and are kind of looking to try to solicit the call it doesn't seem like it's dying down any of that. In fact, some of these folks that are more in the inbound channel, where you traditionally would say, okay, no, they're not doing outbound, they're not doing text, voice, not a big deal, just doing customer and kind of win backs, even those kind of channels are seeing that some of these things permeate, just because the plaintiffs aren't looking for to get even with robocallers. They're looking for deep pockets, and companies that have deep pockets, that, you know, they are starting to fight. So I think that is some of the more good thing is that sooner or later they're going to look for, you know, easier low hanging fruit.
Got it. Thank you. We talked about some lawsuits, results, cases, things like that. How vigilant or how quickly do companies need to be in order to stay on top of legal rulings and other developments with respect to any changes that might need to be made within the organization, Alicia?
I think you need to monitor it. I think you need to have a steady flow of this information. You know, anytime you make a gut reaction to something, in my experience, you forget something. So I would say, you know, with the array of cases and the different decisions that are coming out, just understanding what exactly that means, talking with your legal counsel to understand how you may alter your practices. I would say that any gut reaction needs to be, you know, thought through and measured. And so, you know, again, while it's important to stay abreast of what's occurring and understand kind of what the climate is, I would not encourage any immediate reactions to any cases. And then the other thing that I would mention is obviously watching for the FCC ruling. What I think is going to be very interesting about that is that we're going to get the FCC ruling, and then it's going to provide what people anticipate to be clarification, but it's going to open up a whole new ecosystem of lawsuits. So I realize that wasn't the question you asked me, but it's just, that's a comment that I've been thinking about. And I think it's, you know, it's, we've seen from 2003 and 2008 that, you know, anytime clarification is issued and everybody says, okay, we kind of have the rules and we understand and here's how we're going to operate, plaintiff firms find a way to manipulate that and still file these ridiculous lawsuits.
Got it. Excellent. Well, I just wanted to, we've only got a few minutes left. So if anybody has any last minute questions, now it'll be your last chance to type it in and submit it. And we'll try and get to it before we wrap up in a few minutes. While we wait and see if there are any other questions that want to come in, Ryan, I'm curious, are there any other areas are companies most vulnerable when it comes to complying with the TCPA? Is it about consent? Is it about the ATDS? Where do you see it?
I think it's a combination of that and, like Alicia said, not having somebody that's grabbing the bull by the horns and owning TCPA. I mean, I've seen firms now have TCPA compliance officers. That is their sole role. You know, having somebody that has the knowledge, sometimes you get kind of the compliance is like the hot potato. All of a sudden you get somebody in HR messing with it, and it really needs to have, I think, somebody focused on that and some of the other issues that are related to that at a company, depending on your scale, of course. But, you know, now you see a lot of job growth in that compliance area because of not only TCPA, but some of these things coming out like the California privacy rule and some of the other state things that are kind of emulating that. So.
Okay. Thank you. Before we wrap up, so we got a question that came in. Can either of them comment on the CFPB debt collection rule and any changes that might occur that you expect to see there? I know one thing, for example, that people expect to see is a limit on call caps, or not a limit on call caps, but call caps, a limit on the number of conversations that can be made. There also expect to be some regulation with respect to email and text messaging. How do you think all of that will fit into, you know, what the FCC is doing and what the courts are doing with the TCPA? Sorry, that could be for anybody.
It's a good question. I will say that I've kind of been thinking about that as well. The call caps are going to make for an interesting, you know, kind of intersection between TCPA and FDCPA. And there, you know, the rules in terms of the technology and what you can and cannot do with text messaging and email, again, with that intersection between TCPA and FDCPA, it's yet to be seen, but I think it's just more important now than ever, again, that you understand what your system's capable of, what controls you have in place. And then I will say, just, you know, as an additional thing, I believe that the rules are also going to have additional notice requirements, disclosures for consumers on first notices and subsequent letters as well.
Excellent. Thank you. And thanks for asking a question. Before we wrap up, we've only got a minute or two left. What I'd like to, Alicia and Ryan, what I'd like maybe each of you to do is offer any parting words of wisdom, summarize anything you think the most important things that we've discussed today, or anything you wanted to mention but maybe didn't get a chance to. Just some final takeaways, if you don't mind. Ryan, would you mind going first?
Sure. So I think one of the things I always like to offer people is the chance to see if you have any of these litigators hiding in your data, or in how your reassigned phone number relevancy rates. So happy to run a test and kind of do that for folks. And it's always interesting to see what people have that they didn't know about, and then tie that information back to relevant cases and kind of paint the picture. Because I'm finding a lot of companies are just have some kind of sleeping data that they didn't know about. And I like the format. I think it was conversational, and definitely watch out for the FCC ruling coming out. Hopefully we'll finally get some guidance, and at least people kind of know what they're up against. But appreciate the discussion today.
Thanks, Ryan. And I think everyone echoes your comments. We're looking forward to some rules that everyone can follow. Alicia, your turn.
My theme and throughout this conversation has been inspect what you expect, you know, understand what the rules of the TCPA are, what your internal policies and procedures are, and ensure that you're auditing against those to make sure those are happening within your company. And I would say that, you know, the TCPA is a moving target, but, you know, as long as you're monitoring all of the information that's coming in and kind of modifying your practices as you see fit and ensuring that those practices are then being executed upon properly, that's going to go a long way in the risk reduction for your company.
Great. Thank you. Thank you very much. I want to thank Alicia and Ryan for taking the time to share their insights and their expertise with us today. I really appreciate their support and their participation. This webinar would not have been possible without them. I also want to thank Otto Forster and NEA Insurance Group again for sponsoring today's webinar. Please go to jmprivateinsurance.com to learn more about the company. Thanks to everybody who participated and asked questions. One final reminder, please fill out the feedback survey when you get a chance. Really would appreciate it. And stay tuned to accountsrecovery.net for news and more webinars in the very near future. A recording of this event should be posted to the webinar recordings page, hopefully by the end of the day, but certainly by tomorrow. So check that out if you want to access a recording of this event. Thanks again to everybody, and enjoy the rest of your day. Take care.